You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, Nerdlings. So this is Tracy here with Patrick and our guest for this week, Ben Riggs, who is, hold on to your hats here, because this is going to be so much fun and nerdy insider baseball, a historian of Dungeons and Dragons. Ben's particular specialty has to do with the area of Gary Gygax onward, sort of the transition into the Wizards of the Coast ownership, and specifically looking today, our conversation is going to be about lots of things having to do with D&D, but one of the things I was hoping he was going to talk about is the evolution from Dungeons & Dragons Advanced version 2 to 3.0 and 3.5, which in my household is known as the perfect storm of most fun to play slash most nightmare to run. So, Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Hold on. Yeah. What was your role? Mine, I got a 15 for initiative. So
okay, but hang on.
Fell off the table. 12. You beat me. You go first.
There you go. Okay.
Very convenient that I had a 20-sided die just sitting right by my side. So
clearly, I am not the GM of this episode because I had no idea we were running initiative.
I just happen to have my elder dice sitting here. So.
Nice.
I always have them nearby just in case. So Ben, you never know when you're going to have to worry about the elders coming back.
It never safe than sorry. Okay, so Ben, please take a moment to sort of introduce yourself and get us up to speed with what you know about and what you study.
Well, thank you for that very kind introduction. So I am a writer, journalist, historian, podcaster, teacher, gamer. You know, I have an awful lot of hats. And my work on the history of Dungeons and Dragons kind of fell into my lap. So I think 3 or 4 years ago, I was writing for Geek and Sundry, and my editor was like, hey, I want somebody to write an article about the fact that Wizards of the Coast didn't always make Dungeons and Dragons. And being from Wisconsin and kind of knowing a lot of the guys that were involved in, and I should say women as well, who were making Dungeons and Dragons in Wisconsin back in the day, I volunteered for it. And one article turned into three articles, and they still made me cut things. Specifically, they made cut things that they thought were not positive enough. They were like, this is Geek and Sundry. We want to maintain a very positive tone. So don't say these things. And I'm like, okay, I won't say these things, but this is absolutely fascinating material that I have to see get out of the world somewhere. I'll write a short book about it. And the short book has become 150,000 words, which... I'm pretty sure
science fiction and fantasy geekdom. 150,000 words is like a novella. Don't worry about it.
That is actually a Brandon Sanderson novella.
That is probably accurate, but I don't think my agent is going to let that out the door. So in my first cut, I cut 70,000 words, which I'm gonna call a second book. The first book is mostly about why TSR, the first company to make Dungeons and Dragons, failed and was in a position to be bought by Wizards of the Coast. The second book is going to be about the creation of third edition Dungeons and Dragons, because I anticipated the following would happen. I anticipated I would finish my diagnosis of why TSR failed, and then the last chapter would be, and then it went to Wizards of the Coast, and they made third edition, and everyone was a genius, and it was great. Then I started interviewing the people involved in the creation of third edition Dungeons and Dragons, and I got a much different, much more interesting and conflict-ridden story about how third edition came about and came to be the success that it was. I certainly would have thought that given the fact that third edition essentially is still played today by millions of people around the world, that everyone would just pat each other on the back. But no, they were like, it's been 20 years. I'm just going to tell you the truth about what happened.
Hold on. So the first part is about why TSR failed.
Correct.
So it's about Thaco and Star Frontiers.
So let me get into that.
Okay, at the 7 minute 30 second mark, we had Thaco shade. Put that down on the record.
Well, and that came about for a very specific reason, actually. So, first edition Dungeons and Dragons, Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, I should say, it has significant problems. Like, you could say it's a game that came broken. And one of the designers of second edition, Steve Winter, put an awful lot of effort into saying to himself, how can we make this game better? And one of the obvious things would be, well, remove Thaco. Why do you like just turn it around so that like numbers go up instead of having this weird statistic that doesn't work? And he was specifically told by management that he was not allowed to make that change. And the reason that he was told he was not allowed to make that change was because they had thousands and thousands and thousands of first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons modules sitting in a warehouse in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And if they had made that change, people would say, oh, well, these modules aren't any good anymore. It's not backwards compatible. I can't play it. So they were forced to keep this cumbersome mechanic from the 1970s in a game that came out in 1989 and drove all of us insane in the early 90s trying to figure out what to do with it. But again, it's an example of, you know, a game design mechanic that was foisted onto the designers by management for economic reasons.
And I think that's part of the reason why having you on to talk about this is so exciting for me, because my day job, I teach science fiction, fantasy, literature, and creative writing. And one of the things that bleeds into my teaching as a result of my being a published novelist is talking to my students about the influence that the culture of publishing and the economics of publishing has on the stories that get produced. Who gets published? How are they? How do they become known? You know, what creates success? What are those driving forces and things? Not because I want to sort of steal the gleam from my students' eyes, although probably I am when I talk about that stuff, to be totally honest, but because I want them to understand that there really isn't a universe where like pure art in italics with like rainbows and stuff around it gets to prevail in the face of the fact of working with other people and compromising with other people and the economics and politics really that surround that. And I think there's probably a lot of people who have only thought of their RPG experience of Dungeons and Dragons as being political to the extent that they wanted to play a paladin and that person wanted to play a tiefling rogue, and now they're just going to fight at every single game session.
So I certainly agree with you that economics has really written the path for creativity to follow, especially in the role-playing game and D&D field. Like one of the primary reasons that Advanced Dungeons and Dragons exist. And okay, so I should rephrase. This is my opinion. Advanced Dungeons and Dragons probably exists for two reasons. So first of all, there was a game in the 1970s called Dungeons and Dragons, and there was a bunch of different iterations of it, and it was co-created by Dave Arneson and Gary Gygax. In the late 1970s, Gary Gygax created a new game that he called Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. And first of all, that game probably existed because he wanted to try and come up with rules for tournament play that would be really, really consistent. But also he claimed that Advanced Dungeons and Dragons is not Dungeons and Dragons, and therefore Dave Arneson was not entitled to any royalties for Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, a point which Dave Arneson argued in court.
That's what we would call a lawful evil move.
Yeah. That is a thing that really came back to me several times, was how the TSR, the first company to publish Dungeons and Dragons, really kind of was lawful evil a lot of the time, both under Gary Gygax and CEO Lorraine Williams. And again, Gary Gygax is going to get really screwed out of the company in the mid-1980s, so it's very easy to feel sorry for him. But then also arguing that Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, that Dave Arneson had nothing to do with it, just seems wrong as well. And the pair did not always get along due to lawsuits and a long history. In 1999 at Gen Con, third edition Dungeons and Dragons was announced by Wizards of the Coast. And Wizards of the Coast CEO Peter Adkison managed to get Dave Arneson and Gary Gygax both on stage for the announcement of third edition. And he told me that he was nervous and afraid that something would go wrong with these two, that the two co-creators of D&D on stage 25 years later, that something still might happen in front of an audience that would be untoward or awkward. And they were both gentlemen as it passed. But, you could certainly argue that one of the reasons Advanced Dungeons and Dragons exists is because Gary Gygax maybe wanted to try and get royalties from Dave Arneson. Now, I want to say no, Gary Gygax never said that. But when you look into things like this, so getting actual numbers on the sales of Dungeons and Dragons is really, really hard. Wizards of the Coast, they just this week put out a press release bragging about how much D&D has grown, but there tended to be very few actual numbers in there. They'll tell you things like, oh, our numbers are increasing in Europe, but they won't tell you how many people are actually buying things in Europe, for example. I had a source that gave me sales data that stretched from 1979 to 1999 on a lot of D&D products. Mm-hmm. And one of the fascinating things was discovering that Dungeons and Dragons, the like basic Dungeons and Dragons, sold more than Advanced Dungeons and Dragons or Advanced Dungeons and Dragons second edition combined. Like if you took all the AD&D stuff, both first and second edition, and put it in one pile and then stacked all of those Dungeons and Dragons beginner sets and box sets on the other side, there were more D&D products sold than AD&D products sold. And TSR,
considering how big AD&D got with all of its different worlds and supplements and wow.
I know. It blew my mind too when I saw the numbers. But Gary Gygax, again, like, didn't get along with Dave Arneson, and anytime they put out a Dungeons and Dragons product, Dave Arneson got a royalty. And that kind of animus towards Dave Arneson continued during the Lorraine Williams era, starting in 1986. I had people tell me that she really hated putting out anything that was Dungeons and Dragons because, again, he got a royalty check. And one of her executives actually said, look, we should consider just cutting Dave Arneson a check. Like, give him $2 million, give him $3 million, whatever it takes to get him to give up his share of Dungeons and Dragons. Like, that D&D brand is worth so much money that it would probably be worth it to us. Advanced Dungeons and Dragons sounds like something different. It does not sound like D&D. Everyone knows what D&D is. Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, immediately a question follows. TSR's marketing department, for example, in the early to mid-1990s, they redesigned the Advanced Dungeons and Dragons logo to make Advanced as small and hard to read as possible.
It's not too advanced. This is like remedially advanced. This is
And again, I'm sure that those numbers, I shouldn't say I'm sure, but Wizards of the Coast is run by very, very smart people. And I have no doubt that they looked at those numbers and said, third edition will not be called Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. It's just going to be called Dungeons and Dragons because that is where the brand recognition lies. Stop me anytime you want to, or else I will just keep running off at the mouth. Do you want me to keep running off?
Well, what I want to get into, you mentioned before that Dungeons & Dragons kind of came broken because of Thaco and some other super non-intuitive systems that were baked in. And all that persisted through AD&D as well. So talk to me about when Wizards of the Coast takes the helm, they buy up the product from TSR. What was their sort of, from the interviews that you've done and the work that you've done, what was their kind of ethos? What was their mission? I mean, obviously, yeah, they wanted to make like a super playable and very profitable game, but like what was the driving force for them of how they felt they were going to do this?
So I really feel like the success of third edition falls into two camps. One, there was a marketing business arm that was incredibly successful in creating third edition, and there was also a game design arm that was incredibly successful in creating third edition. Let me start with the business and marketing side first, because I feel like no one ever talks about that. So first, I need to paint for you the grim, dark situation of Dungeons & Dragons when Wizards of the Coast purchased it.
Yeah.
The sales of D&D products were in the basement. You had the first, say, Forgotten Realms products released in the late 1980s sold over 100,000 copies. Settings released in 1996 by TSR sold like 20,000-30,000 copies. So like a 70% decrease from their height. I had one Wizards of the Coast executive, Ryan Dancy, who was brand manager of D&D when Wizards of the Coast purchased it, go over these terrible numbers in a meeting. And he said that the feeling of the room was, you could ask why we paid a dollar for the Dungeons & Dragons brand, let alone the millions of dollars that Wizards of the Coast actually paid. One Wizards board member turned to Ryan Dancy, and Ryan Dancy says, this is not, he's not sure this is exactly what he said, but it was certainly the sentiment. It was, all right, Dancy, do whatever you need to do to fix D&D, but don't lose any money and don't fuck it up. And that was the marching orders for the marketing side. The first thing that Ryan Dancy did was he looked at what TSR was selling and realized the only thing that really sold was core Dungeons & Dragons. And you have to ask yourself, well, what is core Dungeons & Dragons? You mentioned all the worlds that TSR was making. The Wizards team came to the conclusion that the worlds divided the fan base and actually made sales lower, because people would be like, oh, that's a Ravenloft product. Well, I play in the Forgotten Realms, so I'm not going to buy that. There was an experiment where there was a book of monsters. I forget what monster it was, but it was supposed to be a Ravenloft product. They took Ravenloft off it, put Advanced Dungeons and Dragons on it to see how it would sell, and it sold better. So from there on, they were like, okay, we are going to focus on one world. It ended up being Greyhawk, and they are also going to only be selling core D&D products. TSR made a ton of other games. You mentioned Star Frontiers already. There was a sci-fi game called Eternity that was coming out at the time. And the decision was made, we're not going to support any of that. Ryan Dancy called this the nifty. And he realized that the 50 best-selling products were where like 90% of the income lay for D&D. So his marching orders were, we're only doing core D&D, we're not doing any of this other stuff. And you have to ask yourself, what is your marketing budgeting do to sell the nifty 50, our top 50 best-selling products? Because if it's not one of those two things, it's probably not worth doing. Over on the game design side, you had Peter Adkisson, the CEO of Wizards of the Coast, decide that he was going to be the manager of the third edition team. The initial third edition team was a guy named Skip Williams, Monty Cook, and Rich Baker. And then Peter Adkisson, Wizards CEO, was managing them. Peter Adkisson told me that he felt like a kid with a new toy and he wanted his hand on the tiller. And that's why he personally took control of the third edition team. It was also the first time, probably since Gary Gygax left in 1986, that you had a fan of Dungeons & Dragons in charge of Dungeons & Dragons. TSR CEO Lorraine Williams, smart lady, but she was not a D&D fan, and she never really understood the product. She just knew that it was popular and selling well and would do what she could to support that. But now you had a unification where you had a guy who understood D&D in charge of D&D. And on the game design side, Peter Adkisson gave the team the following instruction. He said, do whatever you need to do to make D&D a better game. It doesn't matter if it doesn't carry over from previous editions. It doesn't matter if things are backwards compatible. And it doesn't even matter if we lose players. If we lose 10% of our players on a transition from second edition to third edition, but it makes third edition a better game position for long-term growth, we're going to make that change, were his instructions. Now, the three people that were put in charge of third edition Dungeons & Dragons, Monty Cook, Skip Williams, and Rich Baker, were all from TSR. They all had worked in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin at TSR. And there was a definite culture clash once they moved to Renton, Washington, to the Wizards of the Coast offices. For example, a thing that Wizards of the Coast did that was new to the TSR folk in many ways was something called templated text. To not fall down a rabbit hole of game design, templated text just means that if something is going to do 1d4 damage, you should always use the same language to describe it doing 1d4 damage. And TSR products wouldn't always do that. So the instructions were, oh yeah, and third edition team, use templated text. The third edition team, for whatever reason, decided that they were not going to use templated text. And this comes to Wizards CEO Peter Adkisson's attention. He meets with them and says, hey, you guys aren't using templated text. And the response that the team gives Peter Adkisson is, oh, well, it's too late now. It's too late to use templated text. Pretty weird to be giving your boss and the guy who keeps you off unemployment diktats about when it's too late and when it's not. So Peter Adkisson says, well, when is the next playtest document going out? And they say Friday, or 2 days, I should say 2 days from now. Peter Adkisson locks himself in his office for 48 hours with another executive templating the text of all the spells in advance, hundreds of them. And they get it done in time for it to go out with the playtest document. And the D&D third edition team did not send the templated text of the spells out. Oh, even though their boss told them to do it, He is the CEO of Wizards of the Coast, a fantastically successful company. They still didn't do it. And the people who were there said that Peter Adkisson is not an angry guy. Famously, he cried the first time he had to fire someone at Wizards of the Coast. There was an employee who did nothing but play Quake all day in the early 90s. And when he talked about letting the guy go, he cried. Another person who was there, who was at Wizards of the Coast at the time, said most bosses would have fired the guy out back with a crowbar. But, you know, Peter is such a nice guy. It tears him apart to fire this guy. So he actually gets angry, apparently, at the D&D team. And Jonathan Tweet, who was before this a role-playing game designer, but kind of an indie game designer. He did work on a game called Over the Edge. He co-created Ars Magica with Mark Reinhagen, who would go on to create Vampire the Masquerade.
Genius designer. Both of those.
I know.
Yeah.
He's a genius designer, and he then gets put in charge of the third edition team. And of course, there is some resistance there because he is not from TSR. He did not work in Lake Geneva. He did not breathe the same air in many ways that the TSR designers did. So there was some real resistance there for a while to having him in charge. But he seemed to really win everyone over. It is the Monty Cook told me that the way that Jonathan Tweet ran that third edition game design team is the way any lead designer should lead any game design team, because he led very much by persuasion and playtesting, not by diktat. He could have said, this is exactly what third edition Dungeons and Dragons is going to be, but that is not what he did. For example, they had a deep conflict over initiative. Funny that should come up twice in this episode, but that was what they had a huge conflict over. In the mid-90s at TSR, a very complicated phase initiative system was created where it would depend, when you went in combat would depend on your dexterity, the weapon you used, the spell you used. You had to like declare your intentions before
God, I hate
your weapon
and then. Speed so much.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. God. And the countervailing system was the initiative system we all know today, where you just roll a 20-sided die, add your dex to it, and then it never changes for the rest of the combat. And it's funny because like everyone I talk to, and I talk to every designer on this team, everyone remembers this fight. No one is willing to say that they were the people that supported phase initiative.
Somebody else did, though.
Exactly. Everybody's like, oh, I think it was Monty Cook. No, I think it was Skip Williams. But no one is willing to say I was the one. But the way that lead designer Jonathan Tweet resolved this was not simply saying, well, what I say goes, I'm in charge. He just had them run combat. And first they ran combat using the phase initiative system. Then they used it using the initiative system we all know today. And it was just clear that the system where you roll and add your dex to it was quicker and more fun. So we're just going to go with that. And the fact that the team was able to function through persuasion and through like playtesting like that really is one of the things that makes it stand out in my mind. And it's probably why they delivered such a superior product at the end of the day.
What I love about this story. Oh, no, please go ahead.
No, please tell me what you love about the story, because I can keep talking.
You're like, oh, no, thank God she loves something about the story. What I love about the story is I think it validates for me a theory that I've had for a long time that is at least borne out in my interactions with other geeks in nerd spaces and stuff, and maybe is true for you, Ben and Patrick, as well. But we're a very contentious lot, geeks. We like knowing stuff. We like, you know, even in things that don't have stat blocks, we like to invent stat blocks for them. We like having information and having scoops and, you know, critiquing the physics of something or the accuracy of things. And just there's a high premium put in geek culture on knowledgeability and the authority that comes from knowledge. And I think that's got to be in some way linked to the psychology of a working group that's trying to redevelop and improve upon this sort of like sacred gem of nerd culture, where they themselves were a core part of developing it in the first place. And now they're being asked to sort of go back to it as creators, as fans. And they have their own set of ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how things ought to be done. But in a workplace, you have to have some kind of structure by which decisions are made and by which the path forward is designated. And that requires you to listen to other people's ideas and to do things like admitting to being wrong. And the fact that making that successful product is going to involve admitting to being wrong, or like your interviews are saying, never admitting it, but just going with it like it, you know, was always that way. I think it's a brilliant move to force the team through experience to come to their own realization. I'm doing air quotes here in podcast space that you can't see, because you can't talk them out of it. Because one thing we're good at as geeks is digging our heels in when we think that we're right about something and persisting in these arguments with one another. And so forcing them to go through the experience so that it can be their own decision is, I think, so emblematic of what it is to be not only a creative person stuck in your own sense of what the right thing to do is, but to be a geek creative person, which is like that to the nth degree.
Yeah, I mean, the experience of playing, it certainly does break through that geek impasse. And third edition had 1,000 playtest groups, which at the time was a huge amount, and it provided a lot of data to them, which they followed. For example, and when you mentioned D&D as a sacred text of nerddom, that is 100% accurate, and the way people behave about D&D is as though it is a holy game or some sort of a sacred text. And although we love them, God help you if you commit a taboo and violate the sacred game in some way. And the playtesting did help guide them in what was taboo and what was not. For example, in one version of the playtest rules, they changed the rules to magic missile and allowed you to save for half damage. And then if the monk took a certain feat, the monk would take no damage at all. And it was the only time that in the playtest rules, they got back feedback that was magic missile isn't good anymore. Because clearly, again, people were like, no, we want to roll our D4s and we want to add them together. And that's that. That's what Magic Missile is. And that experience, you know, like just made it clear that even if clearly one of them had a bright idea of like, hey, wouldn't it be fun if we did this with Magic Missile? And the answer was no, do not touch the holy sacred game in that way. The first time that they showed the third edition playtest document to the role-playing game research and development team, one of the most elder D&D designers, a guy named Harold Johnson, supposedly held up the playtest document and smacked it against a table and said, "This is an act of hubris."
That's amazing.
Yeah. But again, it ties exactly into what you were saying about how it really is this central sacred thing. And when Harold Johnson said that, he was accusing them of arrogance, of thinking that you could make these changes to this game. You're just doing this. And when he says hubris, to me, what I read into that is you're only doing this so that you will be known as the designers of this edition. You're making these changes for no reason other than to immortalize yourself.
I was there when the tablets were brought down from the hills of Lake Geneva, boy. Do not speak to me of the old powers.
That is 100% correct. That is exactly the way it is. Peter Atkinson said that he would often ask people, do you want a third edition of Dungeons & Dragons? He'd ask fans this, and the answer would always be no. We do not want a third edition. Don't touch the sacred game. But then he would ask, what changes would you make to D&D? And they would rattle off a list of things. And it came to be a truism that third edition was the things fans didn't know that they wanted. To move back to marketing for one second, the marketing move that made third edition radical at the time was the Open Gaming License. If you don't know what the Open Gaming License is, the Open Gaming License was a proposition put forward by Wizards of the Coast, which would allow you listening to my voice right now, to make Dungeons & Dragons products on your own without sending money to Wizards of the Coast or asking them permission. And again, there were certain things that you were allowed to use, certain things that you weren't. But in the main, you could go and publish a D&D adventure if you wanted to.
Pathfinder. Oh, sorry.
Oh, yes.
Dang. I don't know.
Thank you.
I don't know where. Just had that stuck in my throat there for a second.
And that is exactly the flaw that a number of people pointed out. For example, Bill Slavisek, who I forget his title, but he was also in charge of D&D in some way at the time. He pointed out that this might allow competition to increase. And when fourth edition came out in the early in 2009, and it was less than warmly received, it allowed Paizo Publishing to step up and basically keep creating third edition products under another name. And they became the biggest role-playing game company for a few years. I couldn't tell you how long, but that was exactly the kind of thing that people were afraid of with the OGL. However, the people who argued for the OGL argued about something called network externality. Well, what is network externality? Consider that you own a telephone. Now consider that no one else does. If you are the only person that owns a telephone, that is a useless object to you because there is no one to call. For every single person who gets a telephone, it becomes more useful to you. It gains value the more people have it. And a gentleman at Wizards of the Coast called Scaff Elias believed that Dungeons & Dragons had network externality, that the more people that you got playing D&D, the more valuable the game was. Therefore, you actually didn't want to crush companies that were trying to make D&D products. You wanted to let them do it. Because the more people that those companies got playing your game, the more valuable your game came to be to you.
At that point, you're just letting other manufacturers do the labor of onboarding new players and hoping to sort of slide into it's the non-social media equivalent of we're going to gently slide into your DMs here, new player. This is also, by the way, a podcast where DMs has two entirely separate connotations. But yeah.
Yeah. I think about that every time I listen to Lizzo.
You know, I may or may not be throwing out an unpopular opinion with everybody on the show today, but I prefer Pathfinder.
You know, one of the deep ironies for me is D&D's never been my favorite role-playing game. Like, I love role-playing games, but if you wanted to ask me about my favorite games, D&D is actually fairly far down the list. But, you know, I'm a native Wisconsinian, and in some ways, this story is the story of my state. And for a long time, I was like, it is the depressing story of my state. It is the story of... Wisconsin creatives who were essentially flawed at business and therefore had their product taken by more powerful people from the coast. The more I've learned about it, the more I'm not entirely certain that that basic story holds up, because the reasons that it failed are, in retrospect, TSR never should have failed, but everything is easy to say in retrospect. I think that that level of I interviewed Paizo Publishing CEO and publisher Lisa Stevens about this, because she went with Peter Adkisson to TSR when it was purchased. And I, you know, it was amazing to ask her these questions about her experience of going there and shutting the company down. And I asked her at one point, what lesson did you learn from TSR? And she said, don't do stupid shit. And I'm like, that is, if you boil it down, that's not a bad lesson to take. The mistakes that were made at TSR could be considered just stupid shit. I'm sorry. You were asking.
No, it's not. And she's not wrong. But do you remember like the original Transformers toys?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Okay, so they come out with the Transformers. Kids get their parents to buy them for them.
We're about to be talking about kids robots, aren't we?
No.
Oh,
okay. But but I will throw it out there that I asked for Transformers and I got robots. But no, my point is, you know, they sell them and then they're like, okay, what's next? Well, we need more characters. So let's create more characters and we have more toys. Okay, so they create more characters and they have more toys. They keep doing that over and over and over again, right? They have some new characters, new toys, and then they hit this saturation level and they're like, what do we do? So then they have the Transformers movie. They kill most of the original line so they can launch an all new line of toys because they have to keep selling more toys. That's the whole business model. So how many red boxes are you going to sell in a year? There's only so many red boxes you're going to sell. So they have to do modules, right? Mm-hmm. And then they just sell modules to enhance the red box. You get the red box, everybody gets started, you're playing, you need some dice, you need this, you need that. But we're going to keep selling modules. Eventually, they're going to go, we've saturated. We've done enough. So now we have to go to third edition. Then we have to go to fourth edition because we need to repackage the books and resell them. So basically, TSR and Wizards of the Coast learned their entire model of from Dianetics and from Scientology, right? We're just going to republish the books every year and everybody has to buy them.
I think,
or else.
Putting it.
And that pissed out a lot of people off. Like, there's a listener to the show, JT Evans, and he and I have played a lot of role-playing games together. And his take on 5th edition was anger, for the most part, because he's like, I spent a ton of money on either 3rd or 4th edition to get the books to be able to play this game, and now they're coming out with a whole new system. He's like, I'm kind of angry, but at the same time, this is great. It means that there's now a cutoff. There's not going to be any more fourth edition. I don't have to buy any more of their books. I can now move on to a different role-playing game. I can move on to a different system because I'm not going to keep buying all these books from Wizards of the Coast.
I think, and this is maybe something you can speak to, Ben, and I'd be interested if you've got any perspective on this. I think one of the problems that must face RPG creators is the fact that the whole idea of the whole like backbone of the industry and the enterprise is supposed to be get together with your friends and be creative. Yeah, we're going to give you these supplements and stuff and this stuff, and it's sort of training wheels things. And there are plenty of people who have only ever played D&D out of modules and out of pre-written campaigns. But there are also a large number of people, have no idea if it's just as many, who have used core books and supplements as things, as places to pull together their own stories and to develop them together. And because of that, people who play in that second way that I've described are potentially more independent of the company that produced those products in the first place. So that unless there is a really sexy supplement that comes out that's giving them just the sorts of things that they were hoping to see but didn't know how to develop for themselves, they can kind of continue to play in perpetuity if they're otherwise happy with the mechanics and stuff, inventing their own stuff and sort of tucking it in and adding it. And you talked about the sort of open process as well that Wizards had decided to lean into. Armed with that stuff, it's possible to make a strong initial investment in those products and then maybe not to do it again. So I'm wondering from the perspective of the RPG industry and these creators, do they view that as a flaw in how their system works? Is it just part of how it is? How do they overcome that? How do they deal with that?
So you're describing what I call the consumption problem. Which is you could buy one or two D&D books and play for decades and never need to purchase anything else. I always say, you know, if you want to know what is happening to Superman this month, you have to go to DC Comics and you have to spend some money finding out what's going on with Superman. And you might read that comic book in 30 minutes. If you want to know what's in the newest Marvel movie, you have to pay to see the Marvel movie. And it takes you 90 minutes to 2.5 hours maybe to consume that media. Role-playing games, because they're a radical new form where you are both the audience and the actor, you can play infinitely with very basic rules and never need to make another purchase. Now, what you were describing, that fatigue that you were talking about, Patrick, in second edition AD&D, it was the plan. The fatigue was a problem with the plan, but the plan was, okay, we're going to have all these different worlds. They're going to come out. People will buy the worlds. We will then create a new edition of Dungeons and Dragons, and then everyone will have to buy the worlds all over again. that was the plan. And the irritation that your friend felt was certainly justified. You will notice that 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons has not been following that model. They've been putting out campaigns. They've been coming out with things very infrequently. It's a really different model that they've adopted for 5th edition. But for 2nd edition, for 3rd edition, or for 4th edition, you're really describing what they did. And the fatigue that people felt as a result of that was a definite problem. And I've gotten a few interviews with 5th edition people, but they're definitely hard to get a hold of because they still work for Wizards of the Coast, and Wizards of the Coast is a major corporation. So, you know, they'll talk to me after they've been gone a few years. And then I can find out what exactly the plan is.
Well, I'll throw it out there. I don't like 5th edition, but not because of the game, not because of any of the structure of it. But what happened is in the last year, so I was introduced to Pathfinder. I really liked Pathfinder. Next thing, I meet James Sutter, and he and I got along really, really well. And so I had him on SF Signal quite a bit. We would just talk about Pathfinder, and we talk about the books because they started doing the books they were publishing.
Oh yeah.
And several people that I knew personally and had met at conventions were writing those books. So that was really cool. I liked that. And you know, he even sent me some of the beginner stuff for Pathfinder.
Nice.
So I really started getting into Pathfinder, and I liked it a lot. The people like JT and some other friends were using Pathfinder because they just liked it better than what was coming out of Wizards of the Coast and actual Dungeons and Dragons. But in the last year, I've been invited to two separate game groups to play Dungeons and Dragons. And you want to talk about like contentious and kind of how, you know, we know what we know and knowledge is power and this and that. A lot of times the game groups now, it's like, we're going to start a X edition Dungeons and Dragons game. So you are going to need the X edition rules. If you don't have those, I have them, blah, 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 blah. So you will have people who are like, no, this is a 3rd edition game. Or you will have people say, no, this is a 4th edition game. Or now this is a 5th edition game. And the two groups that I was invited to, both were going to play 5th edition Dungeons and Dragons, which I had nothing. I had no materials on at all. And they're like, one group, the DM says, oh, I've got a book. Like, I've got a copy of the player's manual so we can pass it around. Well, if you've ever been to a Dungeons and Dragons game or any kind of role-playing game, one book is a pain in the ass. Now, how I have played Pathfinder is very simple. I have an iPad and I have the core books on my iPad. I bought them from Paizo. Now, I also bought the hardcovers and I have them on my bookshelf because I am that nerd. I have to have them on my bookshelf.
And bless you for it, sir.
Yeah, but I prefer to carry my, 16-ounce iPad, however much it weighs, that has all of my stuff on it versus a backpack full of books. So my immediate reaction was, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get the 5th edition PDFs. Well, guess what doesn't fucking exist?
Unless you go to D&D Beyond, that's the only way to get them.
You have to go to a website. You have to sign up. You have to pay on the website or do whatever the hell that you have to do on the website. And then you have to have internet access to use it. Well, what if you don't have internet access? What if you're at your friend's house and you're in the basement and there's no internet?
So my initial
experience with 5th edition D&D was that it was complete and utter bullshit.
So interestingly, I was at a seminar where this exact issue was addressed, and the economic answer to what is going on is that Wizards of the Coast gave another company the digital rights to Dungeons and Dragons, essentially, and to digitally producing their works, which means that they cannot do what Paizo made the industry standard, because Paizo created the industry standard of, if you buy the book, you get the PDF for free. And that is a really good standard, and it's pretty much been embraced across the board by every other company except Wizards of the Coast. And the reason that I think it was Jeremy Crawford gave for not being able to do that is because D&D Beyond is essentially a separate company that has digital rights, and therefore they need to make money. And the way that they make money is saying, okay, you want fifth edition product that is digital, you must pay us $30 to $50. Or you can pay for a subscription. A subscription was only like $7 a month, I thought, which was actually pretty reasonable. I mean, that frustration that you are feeling is certainly one of the things that drove people, in my opinion, to Paizo and away from D&D. And again, I think D&D is trying to win people back, and I think it's done a pretty good job of it. Have you looked at Pathfinder 2nd Edition yet or no?
I have not, but let me throw this out.
Throw it out.
Of the two groups, one is a group of writers, for the most part. The other one is not. The group of writers all bought the hardcovers, and everybody had the books. The non-writer group, I went in bitching and complaining about the fact that I couldn't get a PDF. And they're like, well, sure you can. Just go online and get it. Well, no, I'm not going to pay for D&D Beyond. Well, you don't have to. PDFs are out there. Just go get them. And I said, I am a writer. I am not going to go out and pirate published works. And they're like, well, if you buy the hardcovers, you're not pirating anything. You already own it, so it doesn't matter. That's not true.
It's interesting because that industry standard you described, Ben, I mean, I think there's also some very convenient and self-interested logic going there in that situation, Patrick, where they're like, I don't want to pay for things twice. And so I'm just saying I already paid for it, and therefore samesies. But the industry standard that you described, Ben, it is probably a contributing factor to why, since things are done differently in D&D because of that deal for digital rights, and that's different from the rest of the industry standard, people who are inclined to pirate may feel all the more justified in doing so.
Absolutely,
not the same. I hesitate to put piracy is awful, and I have had my own books pirated and things to horrendous problems. And so there are a few things that get me up and dander more than book piracy. And I'm hesitant to exactly say that D&D created its own problem there to the extent that it exists, but it might have created its own problem there.
I think it did. Yeah. I think it did. I have one published novel out there. It was pirated. Mm-hmm. Well, like immediately.
The thing I would point out is that Wizards of the Coast was purchased by Hasbro. I forget the year, but in the early 21st century. And when that happened, again, you had a corporate interest that did not necessarily know what D&D was in control of the game. It's actually somewhat of a...
Can I say it now? Can I say it? Now they know, and
like
knowing
half
is half
the
battle.
Oh, no.
But it's in some ways, it's a miracle that D&D has done as well as it has under Hasbro. And I was once told of a Hasbro corporate meeting where someone mentioned the fact that Wizards of the Coast made novels. And the Hasbro executives had their socks blown off. They were like, we publish novels? We had no idea. And again, that kind of gap in understanding can create problems. And in some ways, it's a miracle that there haven't been more. But what you're describing is certainly that exact problem. Do I have time to put out one other reason that TSR failed?
Sure. I think we could do that and then picks of the week and call it good, sir.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah, because since we talked about the consumption problem, which was real and probably led to declining sales, I did want to point out the cancer that was eating away at TSR, which was a 1979 distribution agreement with Random House Publishing that was agreed to by Gary Gygax and then expanded by the second TSR CEO, Lorraine Williams. This agreement was supposed to solve the problem of TSR's success, because in the late 1970s, TSR was publishing these hardcover books with beautiful color covers, which are, of course, expensive. And the problem is, you might spend, you know, $100,000 publishing the AD&D Player's Handbook, and that might take another year to sell. So you've spent $100,000. It's going to take a year for you to make your money back. And in the meantime, you can't publish anything new because you don't have any income. So this agreement was as follows. TSR would receive a loan from Random House whenever it shipped product to Random House. And Random House would charge them a very small interest fee on that payment. And because TSR products were selling so well, it was never a problem. They just like paid this small fee to Random House, got a loan, and Random House got its money when all this stuff sold. However, as we've pointed out, sales started to decrease in the late 80s and through the mid 90s. TSR did not stop, however, borrowing money from Random House. Instead, they became a company that focused all their energies on simply shipping product to Random House and then running their company off of these loans. But what happens then is, again, sales are declining. Random House is not making their money back, and TSR is stacking up loan on loan on loan on loan. Random House sued them for non-payment at one point because they owed $10 million. And one of the first true death knells of the company was when Random House decided to return all the product that TSR had shipped them that had not sold. And that prompted TSR to start laying people off. But it was this decision not to look at what their sales numbers were and just think about shipping things to Random House, shipping things to Random House, shipping things to Random House, that really got TSR into a ton of trouble. Simultaneously, they didn't pay their printer. So they're literally borrowing money from their distributor, which they are not able to pay back because of poor sales. And simultaneously, they are not paying their printer. In early 1997, their printer finally said they were not going to print any more TSR products until they'd received payment on the money that they were owed. So by the time Wizards of the Coast bought TSR, it was literally a company screwed on both sides of the supply chain. They couldn't create new products, and their distributor was returning stuff to them. So there were a few months where TSR employees described this absurd situation of going into work every day and working on things, and they had this room they filled with products ready to be printed, but that were not able to be printed because of the dire situation the company was in. Did that explanation make sense?
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy.
It was the quickest I think I've ever explained that. Okay.
Good job. There you go. Ever closer to the elevator pitch. So we are at 54 minutes and then some, which means this is a nice, healthy Bouncing Baby Boy episode. And one of the things that was shared with us the last time that we posted an episode was some of our listeners were morose and sad that we did not do picks of the week. So we would be remiss to not do those. So we gave you some warning a couple of days ago, Ben, that we try to do pick of the week fairly regularly and wanted to give you a chance to share yours with us, and we'll share ours with you.
Hopefully this does not turn the episode end the episode on a down note, but 29 days ago, my wife was diagnosed with the coronavirus. Oh, and wow. The following week was probably the worst week of my life, because we're just so accustomed to someone gets sick and there's medicine and they kind of get better. Like that's just the standard. She got worse every day for a week, and there's absolutely nothing I can do. There's nothing she can do. She's taken Tylenol that's not being very effective, which of course is the whole thing, right? Like there's no treatment for this. And my wife is 35 years old. There's no treatment for this. All we can do is stay inside and hope that we don't spread it. But watching her get worse and worse and worse and waiting for myself to get sick was psychologically incredibly trying. And in that dark moment, I turned to, of all things, the Iliad by Homer. And what spoke to me about reading the Iliad in that time was the Greek idea of fate, that you have a fate and you have to accept it to some degree, and there's nothing you can do about it. And because that was the exact situation for that week. There was nothing I could do except wait to see if I was going to get sick. And there was nothing I could do except watch her getting worse and worse and worse. And so I would recommend to you the Iliad, because it actually does speak to this terrifying and terrible moment that we're in, where we are not in control of our biology in the fashion to which we are accustomed. Now, after 7 days, she finally started improving, and it was, you know, two steps forward, one step back. Then this past Monday, she was diagnosed with pneumonia, which, believe it or not, is an exciting improvement. We're very excited about the pneumonia because there's medications for that. There's things you can take. And, you know, 6 days after the pneumonia diagnosis, she's improved. We can go for walks outside. It's the first time she's been outside in almost a month. But that is the thing that I would point your listeners to if they are in a grim and dark place, actually, is the Iliad, in the hopes that the example that Homer sets for us can be some sort of light to you now in this darkness.
That's such a great thing to take out of such an awful situation. I'm so glad that she's starting to do better, though.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Do you mind, which translation? Who's the translator of the version?
I am reading the Lattimore translation, but I would recommend the Fagles translation.
Okay.
I decided to try Lattimore because I hadn't read it, but I'd read Fagles before, and in comparisons that I've done over the course of reading it, I think the Fagles is more readable.
All right. So, Patrick, how about you? Pick of the week.
I'm going to go with Some Good News by John Krasinski.
Oh, that's
if you're not familiar with this.
News Network, right?
This is his news network. It's on YouTube. If you are looking just for something that's going to make you smile, make you happy during these times, that is the thing. That is the thing. He's going above and beyond with Some Good News, and I'm loving it every single time I watch it. He brings in celebrities to surprise people. They did the whole thing with the because he's from Boston. They did the first. The people on the front lines at the hospital got to go to I guess there's some sort of baseball team there in Boston. I've never heard of them. And they play at a field.
Yeah, it's not
as impressive as Wrigley Field. I don't even think they compare. But it was interesting. They got to go there, I guess, and kind of run around on the bases, like go from home plate all the way around back to home plate, which I don't think has ever happened at that stadium.
Oh,
wow.
It's just stuff like that. He threw a virtual prom for kids across the nation, which I thought was kind of cool, and brought in celebrity DJ and all this good stuff. And he's just done a lot of really good things. If I think there's 4 or 5 episodes at this point, plus some bonus content, just go check it out. It's if you're looking for some feel good moments, that is the show for you.
Fantastic. And kind of bringing us back full circle to the geeky theme that we've been wallowing in for the last hour, my pick of the week is a software program called Dungeon Draft. If you were to Google Dungeon Draft, you should be able to find it. It's in late beta and is available for purchase for about $20. And it is a fantastic map generator. If you are, like some people are, myself included right now, playing RPGs with folks remotely and online, you can do lots of things with it that make it very malleable for working with things like Roll20. You can phase out the map grid on it so that you can just do it as a screen overlay on the map grid that's already there on Roll20 and not have to fight and swear at it about trying to make all the little lines go together. It has really cool lighting effects, nice scatter tools. My husband has been playing with it a little bit in preparation for the first full-fledged session of D&D we will have with my soon-to-be 13-year-old son. It's like we were saying before, it's like the holy text of nerddom, right? So he's going to have his like nerd bar mitzvah next week when we have him play this game with us for the first time. I mean, he's played RPGs before, but not like actual D&D with rules. It's mostly just like screaming at friends about made up rules. And it's wonderful, and you're able to make like a really crunchy, cool dungeon with nice switchbacks and interesting cavern formations in literally 90 seconds, and just export it as an image file. So if you are someone who has the burden and pleasure of running games for friends and find that putting together maps is a gigantic pain, for $20, Dungeon Draft can be yours.
Web-based, browser-based? Is it specific to an operating system?
I don't believe that it's operating system specific. And it's an actual software thing, not browser-based. So you're paying $20 for downloading the actual software.
Just trying to figure out if it was Mac or Windows.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and finish.
No, I'm good.
I should also mention, I have a podcast. You would think I would have said that first thing, but I have a podcast called Plot Points where I take role-playing games seriously. We do deep dives on role-playing game products. We're reading aloud the Dungeon Master's Guide with an RPG academic, and I talk more about my role-playing game history stuff there as well. So Plot Points, please check it out.
Well, tell us this, Ben. What's your website? What's your social media? Where can people find you online? So that kind of
the
stuff.
The podcast is at www.plotpointspod.com. We are on Facebook. You can find us at plotpoints on Twitter. I am also at Ben_Riggs on Twitter if you want to find me there. Twitter is not my main jam. And again, I'm terrible at social media because I'd much rather be interviewing people and writing. So you can also email me at plotpointsemail@gmail.com if you have any questions about anything. I have a book that's basically done and looking for a publisher. If you are a publisher, please contact me and I'll put you in touch with my agent. The role-playing game history stuff has really been the material that has got the strongest reaction from any audience I've ever seen. And you can find more of that material on the podcast.
Fantastic. Well, it's been ridiculously geeky insider baseball fun to talk with you here today, Ben. Thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure. If you ever want me on again, I'd be more than happy to come.
Sounds great.
Well, now we have to have a show where we talk about Roll20 because I've had good and bad experiences with Roll20.
I haven't tried it yet. I have not tried it yet, so, and I'm interested in it, so I should.
All right. Well, then it's a loosely scheduled date.
Sounds great. You all have a great Saturday.
You too. Take care.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye, folks.
Hey, we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Functional Nerds Podcast. If you're looking for other great podcasts to listen to, I recommend Beyond the Trope. They premiere new nerdy episodes every week. Giles and Michelle have piled up over 7 years worth of interviews with best-selling authors, award-winning actors, and other leaders in the creative community. And even though, I mean, they've sincerely disappointed me by not coordinating a meet and greet with every dog they know, their Patreon supporters and fans love them for keeping their weekly episodes short, sweet, and full of laughs. Check them out over at beyondthetrope.com. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a backer of the show over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. We have all new levels with some fantastic rewards like access to our patrons-only Facebook group, exclusive extra shows and content like the new video podcast, Just 10 Minutes, book giveaways, yep, we're giving away books, and even short story critiques provided by Tracy every month. If any of that sounds good to you, again, visit patreon.com/functionalnerds. This podcast is copyrighted by the Functional Nerds under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. To learn more about the Functional Nerds, visit functionalnerds.com.